I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this is a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Johannes Brahms' Second Symphony. It took Brahms 21, maybe 22 years to finally write his first symphony, which was premiered on November 4th, 1876. The following summer, while visiting Pürtschach am Wörthersee, a beautiful summer resort then as well as now, located in south-central Austria, it was the perfect place to get away from everything and compose. Brahms rented a couple of rooms, which were comfortable but too small for his piano. Within months, the work was completed and was premiered by the gifted conductor Hans Richter on December 30th, 1877. Whatever had interfered with a composer's ability to write a symphony was clearly over. If you're interested, there's an excellent podcast for Brahms' First Symphony at bsomusic.org. While the First Symphony is replete with conflict and struggle, which may reflect its lengthy and difficult gestation, the Second is Brahms' most lyrical symphony. When Brahms wrote to his publisher Simrock that the Second Symphony, quote, is so melancholy that you will not be able to bear it, I've never written anything so sad, and the score must come out in mourning. Based on the music, I think we can safely say that Brahms was pulling his leg. Before we head to the music, mes petits amis, two things which should be cleared up regarding Brahms and this symphony. One, because Brahms took little time to compose the work, and because it was written in a beautiful place, it has often been called the composer's pastoral symphony and compared to Beethoven's Sixth. While the music is predominantly easy on the ear and bucolic sounding, whatever that means, there's no programmatic intention by the composer whatsoever. Brahms isn't trying to tell a story or portray specific things like Beethoven's pastoral. Two, Brahms is often referred to as a conservative composer and as an exponent of 18th century classicism during the 19th century Romantic period. Allow me to quote the prestigious Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians to explain. In spite of powerfully romantic characteristics in his music, he imposed a traditional sense of order on his music. He thus ranks as a figure of constructively classical inclinations in a romantic age, and as such was widely claimed in his own day as the true upholder of a central German tradition. As usual, Grove knocks it out of the park. While Brahms uses classical-era structure, his music is cutting-edge romantic stuff. Classical bones, romantic flesh. Our symphony is in four movements, and the first movement, the most substantial, is in sonata form. This means that we'll have three large sections, an exposition, where we will meet Brahms' themes, a development, where they will undergo some change, and a recapitulation, where they will be heard again. Brahms uses two principal themes in the exposition. The first has various parts to it and could be considered a theme group. Let's start with the opening. Here's what it sounds like. The very first thing we hear are three notes, D, C-sharp, and D. This is followed by the first melody, which is heard in the horns. This is then answered by music for the winds. If you want to subscribe to the pastoral theory about this piece, the fact that the horns sound very alpine and the winds very outdoorsy, that backs you up pretty well, frankly. Here's the whole thing again. After a bit of Brahmsian meandering, we get to the next part of the theme group. It's a gorgeous melody for strings. So here, once again, the four elements that make up theme one. The three-note idea, the horns, and the Winds. And the Strings. Now that we've established theme one group, Brahms gives us a transitional section or bridge to get us to theme two. It's a bit unstable because it has to take us somewhere. Now it's time to meet theme two. If you think you've heard something like it before, you're right on the money. Yes, indeed, Virginia. It's the adult version of the Brahms lullaby. Here it is again for Winds. If we are aware of these thematic ideas, we can navigate our way through the exposition. And speaking of the exposition, once it is completed, Brahms asks us to repeat the whole thing. There's much disagreement as to whether it should be repeated. At 5 minutes, that's a lot of material to hear again. On the other hand, the complexity of the material argues that hearing it again would be useful. On our recording, the conductor opted to repeat, and I would too. Meanwhile, the development. It focuses exclusively on the first theme group and begins with a statement of the opening theme. Then Brahms uses the tune we first heard in The Winds as the basis for a fugal section. This is a classic Beethoven trick, and it works every time. Then our three-note idea is the subject of development. Then the beginning of the tune returns, but any semblance of pastoral calm is gone. We also hear our beautiful string melody from part one. Finally, after 3 minutes of stormy development, the recapitulation begins and we are home. I know what you're thinking. What about theme 2? How could you leave such a gorgeous theme out of the development? Well, think about it. Beautiful melodies are best left whole. And in honor of that, here is Brahms' restatement in the recapitulation. The second movement is some of the most heartfelt music ever written by Brahms or frankly anyone. Brahms was once asked at a party how he managed to compose such beautiful adagios. He replied that he wrote them very slowly. The opening melody can be divided into three parts. It lasts over a minute. Brahms and Tchaikovsky shared a birthday, which was May 7th, and this is melodic writing worthy of the Russian master. Here's part one of the melody. Here's part two. And here's part three. In the middle of the piece, our idyllic landscape is shattered by an appearance of some stormy weather. What to do with third movements of symphonies was a question that many composers answered differently in the 19th century. In the 18th, the minuet ruled the world. Beethoven replaced the stately minuet with a speedy scherzo. Dvorak used Czech folk dances for his third movements, and Tchaikovsky gave us waltzes. Brahms' solution was the allegretto, not too fast, not too slow, and like so much of this symphony, full of lyrical melody. For variety in this allegretto, we have a more raucous, fast section. We'll alternate between the two types of music for a perfectly satisfying 5-minute movement. The last movement is a fabulous free-for-all, which has been compared to the music of Haydn, but really it's 100% Brahms. It begins quietly, and then explodes. The second theme in this movement is a beautiful hymn. Finally, we end with raucous and justified exuberance. So what's great about Brahms' Second Symphony? One, this is a work that can be appreciated on a wide variety of levels. The symphony is there for you no matter how deep you want to go. Two, the incredible quality and vastness of the melodic material. We get tune after tune and they are all spectacular. Three, a dynamic approach to rhythm. One of the reasons Brahms is able to give us so much melodic material is that the rhythm is always so dynamic. Brahms never met a bar line he couldn't syncopate. Four, beautiful orchestration. Clear, clean, and crisp. Ravel would be proud. Brahms is sometimes criticized for having music that sounds too thick, not here. Five, you get the best of everything. Classical elegance and structure, and romantic harmony and melody. Postscript. In my 3 decades of radio, I have encountered listeners who have found Brahms' music challenging. Frankly, it is. Brahms was an uncompromising maximalist composer. He has packed this symphony full of gems. It might take a few hearings to uncover them, but you will be richer for it. I know I am. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this has been a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Johannes Brahms' Second Symphony.